Amen. Well, it's great always to gather together to see what God has for us in His Word. Last week, as we were in 1 Samuel 19, it was kind of a challenging passage, maybe for many of us, because we were looking at this thing called the dysfunctional family, where there's a control freak in the family who controls everyone else. Everyone else has to kind of enable him or avoid him. They are quite often angry and jealous and bitter, and usually they're really good at diagnosing what's wrong with everyone else, but they don't have a clue about what's wrong with them. And the cost to people who are in a family like that, it's so unhealthy, it's so damaging, it affects you. Well, we saw how David married into that kind of a family. David's family was already that way with his dad and brothers and everything. But now, where he thought, I'm marrying a princess, and now my hero is going to be my father-in-law. My best friend is going to be my brother. And it just seemed like, wow, I've arrived. But we saw right away how, you know, his mentor, his hero, was trying to kill him. His wife, who protected him for a little bit, but now the princess, when confronted with her dad, she sides with her dad and says that David tried to kill her. And now he's sending people out to kill David. And so he's on the run, he's on the lam, and he's like, what do I do now? My whole job is I'm a soldier working for Saul, and Saul's trying to kill me, sending people to kill me. He's, you know, what do I do now? But chapter 20 comes along at a perfect time, because this chapter is about friendship. And friendship is the indispensable commodity that you need to possess, to have, in order to survive the unhealthy dysfunction that exists in families, especially where there's somebody at the head of the family who's trying to control everything. And David's best friend, Jonathan, understood what was going on, understood what was going through, but these guys managed to have a friendship that probably saved both of them. It probably allowed each of them to feel like, okay, I'm not losing it. We see this, we see what's going on, and we're always going to have each other's back. If you've been in a painful family situation, then nothing is more important to you than to have a couple of good friends who are there for you, to help you. And David and Jonathan kind of helped save each other from what they were experiencing at the castle, something that seemed so hopeless. But as we look at chapter 20, we see some things about friendship that will tell you what friendship really looks like. What does this kind of a relationship that helps me to overcome dysfunction and unhealthiness? And we see some examples here in David and Jonathan, one of the great friendships in the Bible. So let's just jump in verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 20. David took off. Saul kept trying to kill him. But Jonathan came to him and said, he said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? David's like, what's the problem here? What you tell me, you've been in this crazy family longer than I have. Why does he hate me? Why does he want me dead? Jonathan said to him in verse 2, by no means, you shall not die. Are you kidding me? He's been trying to kill him. But Jonathan at this point, it's still like, that's his dad. He's trying to believe the best about his dad. He's like, oh no, you're not going to die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. Jonathan, it's not hidden. This is what he's been telling everyone to do, and yet still, here it is, it's your best friend, but you're blind to what's really going on. And David's like trying to go, come on, can't you see this? Now, in this case, David needed Jonathan because he needed to remember that there's also a good side even to Saul. But Jonathan needed David because he needed someone to point out, no, this is serious. This is a problem. So David took an oath in verse 3 and said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said, don't let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. He goes, look, your dad's not telling you everything. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. I'm telling you, he wants to kill me. He may not tell you that, but you need to see this. This is legitimate. So Jonathan said to David, whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you. He goes, you know what? I'm your friend enough that whatever you tell me to do, I'll just do what you tell me to do. David said to Jonathan, okay, tomorrow is the new moon. It was a 3-day weekend, and they would always do a big 3-day, you know, festival for that. And if I don't sit with the king to eat, I'm going to go hide, so I'm not going to show up there. But if your father misses me, in verse 6, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there's a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. And if he says thus, it is well, your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. So David goes, let's just put a test to it. You go to dinner for 3 days. I'm going to hide in the field. If he asks about me and you say, oh, he checked with me, he's heading to Bethlehem, he just went to visit his family for a few days. If your dad says, oh, cool, then maybe you're right, maybe I'm safe, maybe I can come back. But if your dad gets mad, again, a controlling person, their anger is that which shows you what they're really all about. And so he goes, if that happens, then I'm not safe. And so, but he said, we've made a deal, we've made a covenant. Nevertheless, in verse 8, if there is iniquity, if there's something wrong with me, if there's iniquity in me, you kill me yourself. For why should you bring me to your father? So he's like, Jonathan, I don't mind dying, but I would rather have you die me than him, you kill me than for him to kill me. So if there's something within you that's like you actually are trying to talk me into coming back for this, then just kill me. You'll be a hero to your dad. Everything will be fine. But Jonathan said, far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you? He goes, look, I promise. If I thought you were in danger, I would tell you. I'm not trying to sucker you into coming so that my dad can kill you. I legitimately don't, I'm not convinced that my dad is actually going to try to kill you. And so, you know, yeah, he threw spears, but, you know, he does that kind of thing. So then he goes, David said to Jonathan, so how am I going to find out what he says when the discussion comes up, why my seat's empty at the table? And so they went out in the field, and Jonathan said, you know, God's my witness. I'm going to check out what my dad does. For 3 days, you hide out here. And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. In verse 13, he goes, look, you're going to be king someday. I know that. He goes on to have him promise that when he becomes king, he'll be kind to Jonathan's family. In fact, David ended up doing that when he found Mephibosheth, one of the children of Jonathan. He took care of him. Well, that was what Jonathan wanted. Jonathan probably knew, like, if this goes down the way David's afraid that it will, then I'm probably going to end up dying in the process too. But please, we're friends. Verse 15, you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. No matter what happens, please be good to whoever's left of my family. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David and said, let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies. Now, verse 17, Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him. For he loved him as he loved his own soul. What a great description of friendship. I love you the same way I care about myself. Your interests are my interests. We are connected at the level of the soul. And so he said, okay, go ahead, you hide out here, and I'm going to go run this by my dad at the meal. We'll see what happens. He said, when I come out here in 3 days, I'm going to bring a kid with me, and I'm going to be like shooting at birds or whatever with arrows. And he said, here's our code word. If I tell the kid, he says, look, the arrows are on this side of you. Get them and come. If I say the arrows are next to you, that means you're cool. Come on out, everything's fine. You can go back to the palace. But if I say to the young man, look, the arrows are beyond you, then go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed, the Lord be between you and me forever. This isn't about me and you. This is about, I will let you know if it's not safe for you to come back or if it is. So they go to the feast. David's seat is empty. Saul doesn't say anything the first day because Saul thought, I'm sure David's probably unclean. He probably killed somebody, so he had to go through rituals in order to come to the meal, and so he's just social distancing right now. So he's okay. But the second day, David's still not there. And Saul goes, hey, Jonathan, where is the son of Jesse? What happened to him? Where did he go? And so he asked him that, and happened the next day. Saul said, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today? So Jonathan answered Saul, verse 28, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table. So Jonathan did this whole story that he and David had talked about. Seemed like a good plan, except there are some people who just aren't good at lying. And I think that was probably Jonathan. My wife, Anne, is that way. It's not that she doesn't lie. It's that when she lies, it's so obvious. I'll never forget one time my brother and I and Anne went into Tijuana, walked across the border. Well, my brother bought a switchblade, and he didn't have a place to hide it, so he said, just put it in your purse, Anne. And she's like, no, I can't lie. They'll know. And I go, come on, just stick it in your glasses case, bottom of your purse, we'll be fine. So I walk through the border, nobody says anything. My brother walks through the border, they don't say anything. I turn around and I look at Anne. She's clutching her purse like this, and she's... And she just put the purse down, and she's like, she's really subtle. She's going, Dave, are they going to throw me in jail? They're not going to throw you in jail. So she ended up pleading guilty to smuggling, and we had to pay. They said it was a $10 knife. We really paid $5 for it, but we had a fine of $20, and then she was off. But she goes, I told you the whole way back to the car. I told you I can't lie. I think that's probably kind of how Jonathan was. He's like, you gave me a good lie. There's nothing wrong with the story. I'm just not the one to execute this. Because his dad knew him and said right away when he told this whole story. And then Saul's anger, in verse 30, was aroused against Jonathan. And he said to him, he let out his controlling, abusive language that Jonathan was used to hearing, Saul was used to giving. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me. He shall surely die. Now, people who are like this, quite often, they actually, like, it doesn't seem like Saul's worried that he's going to lose the throne. He really does care about Jonathan. He wants Jonathan to get everything that he has coming for him. And he's going, you're so stupid, you don't realize this guy is ripping you off and your family off. He will kill all of us. Jonathan already had that thought. That's why he made that covenant with, like, hey, after I'm gone, will you take care of my family? Because in those days, somebody, a rival, their family was a threat to you. So very typically, you would kill off anyone who might lay claim to the palace. So what Saul's doing here, it's not, I'm not saying that, well, he was a great guy. But what I'm saying is, in his mind, he thought, I'm thinking of you, Jonathan. And even for Jonathan, perhaps he's thinking, well, I mean, I get why my dad's upset, because my dad really loves me. That's partly how people can manipulate other people, by the way. And sometimes it's absolutely sincere, but it's always in anger and it's always in control. And so, you know, he said, as long as he lives, you're not going to be on the throne. And Jonathan, in verse 32, answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? Saul was like so mad. He threw a spear at his son, the one that he was so concerned, he was trying to protect his legacy, and then he chucks a spear at him like he had David two other occasions. And by that time, Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. He's like, if he's trying to kill me, I think that's all I need to know. David is not safe here, and I need to get to him and get him the message. So Jonathan got up from the table in verse 34 in fierce anger. It really made him mad that his dad would try to kill him. The dad that he had defended, that he had fought alongside, that he had respected and elevated, that his dad would not only want to kill his best friend, but his dad would actually want to kill him because he was that much out of control. But he was also grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully there in verse 34. So he got up in the morning and he shot the arrow. And he called out there in verse 37 to the kid that was getting his arrows, is not the arrow beyond you? And that was the message to David. Not it's near, no, it's beyond you. And so then the kid ran and got the arrow, brought him back, and he goes, here, take my bow and arrow and everything and go put it back in the palace and I'll be right with you. And then David ends up coming out, and as soon as the lad was gone in verse 41, David arose from a place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times, and they kissed one another and they wept together. But David more so. They were like, this hurts both of us. David was even more hurt because he just lost his wife, his home, and everything else. Jonathan's hurt because he loves David and because he's discovered something about his dad that he really didn't know until right at this moment. It was hard. I finally have somebody who has the same kind of courage and strength and faith in God and friendship that I want. And now he's leaving. I may never see him again. Now, they would stay in touch and they would see each other a little bit, but it was costly to both of them, and so they were crying together. And Jonathan said to David in verse 42, go in peace. Since we've both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. He's still like reminding him, remember what you said about my descendants. So he arose and departed. Jonathan went back into the city. Boy, nobody needs a friend like somebody who finds themselves in a situation where everything that you do is dictated by someone who's trying to control the narrative. And growing up in this kind of abusive environment, this kind of unhealthy, dysfunctional environment, your friend is your only salvation. The only way you can recover from what you've been through is to connect with a friend. And yet, when you grow up in this kind of an environment, it's not easy to find friends or to make friends because you've been so damaged that you just don't trust anyone. If you can't trust your parents, who can you trust? And yet, God is faithful and brings opportunities where if He so blesses you and you respond to it, that there's another person who can become your friend in a way that helps you to be able to work through all the pain and challenge in your life. And David and Jonathan both needed that, and they each found it in the other in a really special and a powerful way. When I look at their friendship, though, I see some things that are just like, here's what friendship really looks like. Because we all have people that we call friends. We all have acquaintances. We have, you know, people in our lives, like if you're on social media, look how many friends I have. You know, I have a lot of friends. Every once in a while, when somebody asks me to be their friend on Facebook, I have to blow off some Nigerian prince in order to make room because you're only allowed to have 5,000. And, you know, but are all those really your friends? We like to call them that. That's the way the world is. You might have a lot of acquaintances, but how many friends do you have in this context and in this way? And they're few and far between, but the ones you have are precious because they actually not only save your life sometimes, they save your sanity and your health, and they allow you to know that you're not an evil person or that you're not such a sick, damaged individual that you're beyond hope. So their friendship, several things that I see happening here that are important to friendship. One of the first ones is, and starts out in the beginning of the chapter, a friend will help you see your blind spots. There are certain things you see, and there are certain things that you don't see. And I suppose for both of them, David may have just thought, there's nothing good about Saul. Jonathan could see his dad, and he's like, I mean, he's always been pretty nice to me, and I know he's under a lot of pressure, and he had kind of a weird upbringing, and he could make excuses for him because that's his dad. He's lived with him his entire life. The way he looks at it, I wouldn't even have a job if it wasn't for dad. And so he's blind to what his dad is doing, and he's trying to explain to David that, no, I'm sure if he really wanted you dead, he would have told me. He's already told you, and you can't hear it at that point. It takes a friend, and this goes both ways with these guys, who can say, I see something that you don't see. Now, it wasn't to dictate what you would do. They didn't talk down at each other. In fact, David makes that powerful statement. He's like, I don't mind dying. You can kill me. I'd be fine with that. You know, but you need to take a second look at your dad because I know he wants me dead. Now, if somebody came to you and said that, and you thought that your dad was amazing, how would that affect your relationship? That'll tell you whether this is a real friendship or not. Because, and friends have the capital with you because they've been with you, they're loyal to you, they have the capital to be able to say, you know, you might want to take a second look at that. They don't tell you what to do, but they help you to see something that you may not have thought of. And so this is what they did, and it worked in a real synergistic way, in a just a beautiful partnership whereby, and it went for the rest of their lives, each one of them could tell the other one what they weren't seeing at the moment. I mean, you can argue that David maybe couldn't see anything good about Saul. Jonathan probably helped him to see that some of the good that was in him. But Jonathan was blind to his father's psychotic, you know, delusions. David saw it and he's like, you know, you ever think about this? I mean, come on, look, just look at it. I'm on your side. I just want you to consider this as a possibility. And then he goes, let's just put it to the test and we'll see. It's not like pounding him over the head with it. It's just like, okay, I will share with you your blind spots. A friend can do, somebody who isn't your friend doesn't have any business trying to tell you your blind spots. It just creates an argument. But somebody who's proven their friendship has the capital to be able to suggest to you, look, you know I love you. You know we are friends. You know I'm on your side. But have you ever thought of this? A friend will always have your back as well as they did in many, many occasions throughout the rest of their lives. It was like, okay, there are some people that you think have your back when they really have your back so they can put a knife in it. But a friend is somebody who is like, you don't have to wonder whether they are supportive of you. You don't have to worry about, oh, are they saying other things to other people, but then they're saying to your face the things that you want to hear. That's not that unusual. That's what most people do. It's probably the easiest thing to do. If you really don't want to be a friend, just tell people what they want to hear, and it keeps you out of the drama. But a friend will inject themselves into the drama by saying, you know what? If you're whatever it is that happens, if you're guilty or innocent, if this happens or it doesn't happen, if you do this or if you do that, I have your back. I will always be here for you. And that's incredibly important when you've lived in an insecure environment where you don't know who you can trust. How many people do you need to have your back? Just one would be nice sometimes. And so that's what their friendship was for them. But also, friendship takes risks. Friendship doesn't play it safe. If someone's really your friend, they are willing to lay themselves on the line in order to be supportive of you and to have your back. If somebody won't take risks for you, they're not really your friend in this sense. Quite often, people will, you know, act like they're your friend, but if it starts costing them something, well, sorry, not my friend anymore, because you're not doing for me what I need you to do. But a real friend is somebody that says, if you're doing something crazy, I'm in, come on, let's go. I'm in on it with you. We'll figure this out. I think it's crazy, but you're worth more to me than what I'm risking by standing by your side. The other thing, and you know, that moving scene where they were crying together, but David was crying even harder than Jonathan. At this point, he had more to lose, I think. But a friend has empathy for you. A friend will, as the Bible talks about, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. When you're rejoicing, your friend isn't the one who goes, yeah, but you need to, you know, you may be enjoying this meal, but there's children starving in India right now that don't have. They aren't like, oh, you think this is great, but, you know, just wait around the corner, you're going to fail again. A friend, when you're doing well, they celebrate with you. But a friend, when you're hurting, they don't tell you to cheer up. They don't tell you, come on, you're being a baby. That's not friendship. Sometimes to be a friend, you just have to be empathic enough to go, because we're friends, I feel what you are feeling. Because in a dysfunctional environment, your feelings are completely discounted. In a friendship, your feelings are legitimate. The last thing you need is somebody to tell you you shouldn't feel the way you do. The greatest thing you need is to go, I understand how you feel, and I'm feeling it right with you. I'm not just trying to fix you. I'm empathizing with you. A friend, a true friend, is also just, you know, in a completely, they are committed to you in an unconditionally. It's not like, if you do this, then I'm with you. But if you do this, I'm not with you. Unconditional commitment and acceptance. As, you know, there's an expression that people use a lot now, ride or die. And they say, that's my ride or die friend. The phrase ride or die came from bikers originally, but now people have appropriated the term. And what they mean is somebody who's like, they're going to be with me no matter what. We ride or we die, but I'm by your side. That's something that unconditionally, that's what friendship does. If your friendship is conditional, it's really not much of a friendship that'll help you at all. Heck, the psycho that tries to control you will accept you as long as you're doing what they want you to do. But another thing with these guys that jumps out is, from everything that we've read about them, these are two of the most and almost only truly spiritual people in Israel at this time. What drew them together wasn't that, man, you're a bad, you know, soldier. You know, you are somebody who's great at what we do. But for both of them, that heart for the Lord, that spiritual connection, it's what brought them together. Everything else was a sidelight to that. Sometimes there are people who are totally different than you are, but they have such a love for the Lord, like you do, that you feel this bond between them. Some of your best friends will be people who aren't much like you, but they love God the way you do. And I think that was what held these two together for their entire lives, is that spiritual connection. I'm not saying that you can't have a really good friend who doesn't believe the same as you do or who isn't a Christian. Because there are some non-Christians that are better friends than a lot of Christians are. But what I'm saying is the deepest connection you can have with someone is at the level of the Spirit. And so to me, that's where you start. I mean, if you're looking for who in my life can I really make this connection with, somebody who values a relationship with God is a good place to start. And that's a part of what they did, what they did. But for me, one of the most important things about David and Jonathan, and it's one of the most important things about real friendship that we desperately need, they weren't trying to control each other's decisions. They didn't become dysfunctional in their relationship. It was, again, like I said, it was unconditional, but it was also, Jonathan, you're going back to work for your dad. I'm heading off to do, as we'll see, some of the times he worked with the Philistines, did all kinds of stuff, lived in caves. Neither one of them tried to influence the other one to change their mind about what they needed to do. Now, again, offsetting true friendship with dysfunction. Dysfunction is about how can I make somebody else do what I want them to do. Friendship is about saying, I'm going to be your friend. I'll always tell you the truth, but I'm with you, and you don't have to do what I think you should do. A part of what I do as a pastor and counsel is people come in and they just want me to tell them what to do. And I try really hard not to do that, because I don't think that's what a friend does. I think that's what somebody who is dysfunctional does. They try to make you do. And there are times, though, and I'll give somebody something to think about. I'll make a suggestion. And in fact, most of the time it's this way. People don't really take your advice anyway. It doesn't hurt my feelings. I don't care. I don't have anything at stake here. I will tell you the truth. You come and talk to me, I will tell you the truth. But I'll care about you. I will be your friend if you decide to do exactly the opposite of what I think you should do. I am so thankful for friends in my life who I knew I did things that they thought was stupid, but the friendship wasn't negotiable. It's like, I know they'll support me either way, and they will tell me, this is your decision. And especially when you come out of a dysfunctional background, you desperately need somebody who respects your right to make decisions, and that's what friends do. Let me tell you what this looked like for them. I look at the story, and I'm like, and I ask a question about this for the small groups this week, that I think is interesting. Like, for me, honestly, I see this chapter and I'm like, Jonathan, why did you not bail on your dad and go with David? Why did you not really lay it on the line? Can you imagine the kind of loyalty? The people love Jonathan, they love David. Jonathan going with David would give David such legitimacy, probably would have come to the throne a lot sooner. More guys would have rallied with them. They were two of the most effective warriors in Israel. Can you imagine the damage they could have done working together side by side? And then at the end of a long day, supporting each other, praying for each other, knowing I have your back every day. To me, it's like, come on, Jonathan. And I'm kind of surprised that David didn't lay that trip on him, but he never did. And for Jonathan, he thought, look, let's get a mediator. Maybe Samuel will come down and meet with me, you, my dad. Let's talk all this out. You can come back. I know my sister's kind of a loser, but she's hot. So, you know, come on. I mean, let's just work all this out. Either way, it could seem like this is a win-win. So it's amazing to me that they remained loyal to each other and friends, even though for each of them, the other was going against what would seem to be in their best interest, what would seem to be what looked like the wise thing for either of them to do. And I wrestled with that a lot. And I think my question for the small groups is, how would things have turned out differently if Jonathan had just said, I'm with you, let me go back and get some of my armor and stuff and some of my loyal followers, and we're going to go to town. It would have been interesting. But at the same time, when you think about it, later on, David had a trusted best friend who was in the inner circle of Israel, who would have intel coming his way to know where Saul was and what he was trying to do. So you can make a case that actually for them to go separate ways in this way, they could cover more ground, they could cover more territory this way. It's an interesting thing to think about, but the thing that I want you to remember is, you know, friends don't tell somebody, I will be your friend if you do what I think you should do. They don't lay those kind of ultimata. They're honest, and then they're like, well, it's okay. And there are people who are like, okay, I feel like I need to go to a different church. People are like, well, if you're not going to be at my church, I can't be friends with you anymore. Well, you see this all the time when you have two friends that are Christians who get divorced, and you feel like you have to pick, because neither one of them will be your friend if you're going to be friends with the other one. People are always laying down these restrictions. That's not friendship. Friendship is, you know what? I will be friends with whoever acts friendly to me. I won't pretend to agree with what they do, but I will wish the best for them, and I will try to be faithful. You will have enough real enemies in your life. You don't need to inherit enemies by trying to control people. And the most unhealthy thing that you'll ever do in your life is to control the will of another person. And if you can't get rid of that tendency, then you will never be healthy. And the best way to be healthy, and you can start with your best friends, is go let them know. You know, I'm thinking this would be a good thing for you to do, but if you do something else, I'll be with you. I hope it works. I've had people that married somebody and I just thought, this is a bad idea. And if I'm close to them, I'll go, I don't know, man. But then I think if they end up marrying the person anyway, it's nothing personal against me or my advice. In fact, they need a friend even more after they marry that person. And so that's what friendship does. Now, with all of what we've said about friendship, there is a perfect model for friendship, and his name is Jesus. He said, I call you friends. I didn't come here to beat you over the head, to lord it over you. I came here to be your friend. So sharing with you when you have blind spots, he always tells you the truth. Having your back, always. Making sacrifices for you, oh my. He gave his life for you. How about empathy? Rejoicing with those who rejoice, weeping with those who weep. That's why he came. Hebrews tells us he became a person and lived a human life for 30 years before he ever went into the ministry because he wanted to feel what we feel. He wanted to connect with us on that deeper level, unconditionally accepting us, having a deep spiritual relationship with us, and then never saying, if you don't do what I want you to do, this friendship is over. If that was the case, I mean, that's like some of the really extreme Pentecostal churches where if you did anything wrong this week, you need to accept Jesus again this week. So they would always party on Saturday nights and then they could get saved again on Sunday morning. But Jesus is not that dysfunctional person who's like trying to control what you do. He's like, I love you. I've tried to be an example to you, but you know what? You can live your life. You can make your decisions. I will never leave you or forsake you. I will always be with you. So what we're looking for in friendships is ultimately what Jesus has taught us to do. And if we could live life more like he does and look for people who are doing that as well, man, the power of those kinds of friendships to heal the damages within us, it's just enormous. You might be going, it's nice that you're talking all about friendship, but I don't have a friend like that. Well, Solomon tells us, if you really want friends, you need to be friendly. So the real question is, how are you treating other people? What kind of a friend are you to them? And it doesn't infallibly mean that then they are going to be this kind of a friend for you. That would be manipulation. But you have a greater chance of connecting with people on a deep level if you treat them this way, with this kind of loyalty and this kind of love and concern and you know, communication. So, you know, now you might go, boy, this reminds me of a lot of people in my life that I thought were friends. And now they bailed on me. I've lost so many friends. You've never lost a friend, ever. You only find out who is or isn't your friend. If somebody has bailed on you, that's a good thing, because that's how you discover they weren't really my friend. I mean, you could be friend, like Facebook friends, fine. You know, but people that you really are in relationships with, you'll find out who they are partly by the process of elimination, as your so-called friends drop off. And that's really a good thing. It creates space in your life for those people who will honestly be friends with you. And again, the deepest place for this, we find it in the spirit life, in our connection with God. It's why a lot of times you'll meet your best friend when you're serving the Lord together. And you're like, wow, they care about what I care about. Or you go through a really hard time where you lose almost everyone in your life and there's just one person still there. It's like, that's a good thing. But it's important for us to remember what a friend does so that we can be the kind of friend that will take, that will receive as a great gift when God has brought those into our lives who connect with us in this deep and important way. And you don't need 20 of them. And if you have one or two, you're really fortunate. Sometimes clearing certain people out of your life to make space for others is a good thing. And so to me, that gives me great hope that no matter what kind of unhealthy environment you've been in, you're always just a discovery of a friend away from overcoming that and being able to create a different kind of, you know, dynamic in your relationships with others. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for being a friend to us. Thank you for sharing this story about David and Jonathan. It's powerful. How many of us just have longed to have somebody like that, tells me the truth, has my back, connects with me on a deep level. But help us to be those kinds of people, and help us to enjoy and relish in the fact that we have a friend, that in fact nobody has a friend like Jesus. And so, Lord, help us to be those, and to look and to praise and thank you for the opportunities you give us to connect with others in our lives. We thank you, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.